So hi, this is Gavin from FE News. I've got the great privilege to be chatting with David Price, who's launching a new book today, this Friday. And it's the new book called The Power of Us. How do we connect, act and innovate together? How are you, David?
I'm good, Gavin. And I'm very well. It's a bit stressful, but it's okay.
This is obviously a really interesting time to be launching a book, because as you've mentioned in the past, we're in a very interesting time where it seemed like the world before was a bit BC, so before Corona.
Yeah.
We're stepping into a time of after Corona, but we're actually right now, as you've said, we're in a DC during Corona.
Yep.
And it's what I'm really, really interested in, which I think our audience would love to hear, is what can we learn from the process we've been through? What does it mean to the future of education and the future of work? Because it seems like nothing is ever going to be the same again. Obviously, some things will be, but what can we learn? How can we take this as a learning experience and have a solution to move forward and to make things better?
Yeah, it's a great question, because when I'd actually written the book, pretty much finished it by beginning of March, and my wife and I were over, we were training teachers in Australia, and the tour got cut short, you know, as the implication happened and everything just started, all the dominoes started falling. For us, it was a case of, can we get back to the UK in time, because they were closing the airports. But when I got back, I read a thing by Tom Friedman, who writes for the New York Times, and he says, just as you said, there'll be this period of which will be remembered before Corona and then after Corona. And it said, if you're working on a nonfiction book, just put it down, because nobody knows what's going to happen after Corona. And whilst I saw what he was getting at, for me, the really interesting thing and why I really felt I had to almost rewrite the whole book was what was happening during Corona, because I know this has been a terrible, terrible pandemic around the world, but it would be wrong to say that it hasn't brought out some amazing qualities in people in terms of what I call mass ingenuity. And so I felt that was a really important kind of affirmation of what the book's about, which is really about, I mean, when my first book, which was called Open, and it was about how social learning works, you know, and people would say to me, just tell me what the book's about, but like in 30 seconds, and I could never do it. This time, people say, so what's this book about? And I go, you know that Mercedes Formula One team, you know how they did the continuous breathing machine with UCL, and they did it in less than 100 hours? It's that. And there've been so many examples of cross-disciplinary people working together, but also what I found really interesting, particularly given the first book that I wrote, is that we've seen this shift towards open source, and there's been a whole series of movements, I think, which have arisen from this. But the only way we're going to get a vaccine as quickly as people are talking about is because China made the genetic material available on open source. And that's been the same, whether it's a design for a face shield or for a new kind of ventilator. So there's been this willingness to share information. And I think the interesting part was a willingness to drop the expert novice divisions that we've traditionally had. So two of the people that I talk about in the book, one of them is a young Korean lad, he's 19, he's called Ryan Jinseo Hong. And in 3 days, he built a COVID tracking app for Korea, when Korea was at the height of its outbreak. Similarly, Avi Schiffman, a young kid in Washington State, He's got the world's most authoritative coronavirus website, tracking website. Anthony Fauci says it's the first place he goes when he needs up-to-date information. And here we are, the British government still hasn't built this COVID tracking app. And you think, a bunch of kids living with their parents did it in 3 days. What's wrong with this picture? And one of the lines I say in the book is communities are outperforming bureaucracies. And I think this is for people in my generation, the baby boomers, it's a lot to get your head around the fact that these kids are doing really incredible work and they're networking, coming together. What I think is sobering about Abby Schiffman is that he was interviewed by MIT. He was made Webby Person of the Year for the website because he didn't just do that one. He did one which was tracking the George Floyd protests after that murder. And MIT said, you know, you must be a really good student at school. And he said, no, I'm a terrible student. He said, I got something like a 1.7 grade point average. That's out of a maximum of 4. And he just said, I'm a really poor student because I just want to work on coding and apps. And I just think there's something wrong with our education system that we can't recognize kids for what they know rather than judging them by what they don't know.
I 100% agree. I think that's probably one of the most interesting points that I've seen from the details I've seen on the book is your point on Avi. And what can we learn from an education system of where we can encourage people that are, Avi's obviously totally dedicated into finding solutions, you know, development, looking at new ways to disseminate information for everyone to be able to see. These are all the skills, high level skills that everyone is asking for in the world of work. And yet in school, he's being penalized for that. Yeah. Like you're saying, he should be getting a 5 instead of getting a 4.
Yeah, of course. You know what I mean? Yeah.
So how can we sort of learn from that as an education system? Because, you know, we've had our own problems with algorithms and
we sure are.
And of course, everyone's, you know, learning on the job quickly at the moment. And, you know, I wouldn't want to be the person, you know, trying to put that algorithm together because it's a very difficult task to do.
Yeah.
But what can we learn from Avi's example? What can we do to bring that back into education? How can we not go back to penalizing Avi's
education? Well, I think one of the things that this has thrown up and people like Avi keep reminding me is that we apply standardized testing in a world that's no longer standard. And to me, that just doesn't fit anymore. And what I thought was interesting about the A-level and GCSE fiasco was that the argument was, it became about whether the algorithm was fair. And what wasn't being recognized is actually increasingly employers aren't even taking any notice of qualifications. The number of employers who look at, who ask now for a 2-1 degree has fallen from 76, 5 years ago, 76% to something like 50%. And increasingly now people like Google and Ernst & Young, you know, high end, knowledge sector economies, they're saying, oh, I'm not interested in what you know. I'm interested in what you can do with what you know. So that's what Avi did. And I the book is full of examples of young people who've done, you know, amazing things. And I just think if you're a young person and you've been, you know, making face shields, as I know thousands of students have been doing during lockdown, you know, sons and daughters of key workers have still been going into school. And I think you feel like you're doing something really useful, you're still learning. That needs to be recognized, it seems to me. And more than anything, if you then go back to, you know, filling in a worksheet, it's not really going to cut it for you anymore. So for me, one of the things that I did a few years ago was I got involved in a thing called the Mastery Transcript Initiative. And it's an American initiative, but it's becoming global because it recognizes that what employers are looking for, what universities are looking for, is it can't simply be judged by a number. So it's an alternative transcript, and it looks at things like leadership skills and how well can students collaborate. And it doesn't give grades, but it gives a kind of spider diagram so that these students can take this to universities. And what was fascinating was purely timing was that this year was the first time it had been trialed. And of course, this was the year where even in America, there were no standardized tests. So the students in the schools who participated in this, and it's a mix of schools and you've got Ivy League colleges, you know, Yale and Stanford and people like that. They all were thrown. This was the only thing that they could fall back on. And they said, we feel like we know these students so much better. as a result of this. This gives us an all-round picture. Because where do you get a GCSE for grit or perseverance or resilience? You know, you don't. And there are young people out there. And, you know, I started off in FE and I used to say to my colleagues, you know, we have no idea some of the lives these kids are leading. So let's not judge them. You know, at 17-year-olds who were living in a squat in Moss Side, you know, and it was just hard for them to get out of bed in the morning. People who are carers, yeah, 15-year-old carers. And so I think somehow we've got to recognize that. We've got to find a system which kind of credit what they've been doing. And one of the case studies in the book, I went over to Dubai and I looked at a thing called the Knowledge and Human Development Association. It's kind of like Ofsted, it's a regulator for schools over there. But what they've done is they're trialing a system whereby as a student, you could study at up to 4 different schools or colleges. You can have your passion accredited, so you can spend a couple of days a week doing that. Or if you think you might be interested, say in, I don't know, photography, you can have a couple of days a week with a photographer, and that would be accredited. It's an incredibly flexible system, and it's early days yet, but I came away from seeing that, convinced that, yeah, more people are, we're going to have to move to this kind of personalized assessment system. Because sadly, I think what standardized testing has done in education, it's shaped everything else that leads up to that. So the curriculum is about informing what the standardized requirements are, and so is the pedagogy. So for me, if we could use this virus as the point at which we said, and I think we have seen that. We have seen parents who've questioned the validity of the qualification and the stress that the students have been under. You know, I find it staggering right now that politicians are talking about the need for these students to catch up. So we'll give them more tests to see how much they've lost while they've been away. And you just kind of think, give these kids a break. I know the assessments were generous this year, so they should have been. Because what these kids have gone through, in addition to studying and getting through their course, it's astonishing. So for me, the very long-winded answer to your question is that I think now everything's up for grabs, and I think other countries are starting to really now talk about fairly radical change. And I think we need to start doing that. And frankly, in this country, we're not going to get that from the politicians. So it's down to us as educators.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, there's talk of the white paper in the autumn and looking at Germanic systems and all the rest of it. And I think there's some things in the Germanic system which are fantastic, like the way you can take the different routes, and it sounds very similar to what you're talking about with yeah. Dubai. And I pick up what you're saying around politicians saying what learners have missed out on, but what else have they gained?
You know, exactly.
You know, there's been so much when they've had to do their own self, talk. They've had to learn without handheld in all the way and using different technology. How can we move that sort of forward? I could talk to you forever about that topic on its own right, David. you mentioned your previous Bank of England governor, Mark Carney, around the whole sort of idea of the way work could be changing around particularly large employers and also small. And I think early part of COVID had a very different dynamic, didn't it? Where large employers were just laying people off and it was just like, whoa, what they're doing. And small employers, local, were being like this sort of big heart mentality of, making sure that they're looking after their community. How do you feel that can sort of, we're seeing a change with these, during COVID, and what could that mean for after COVID with the world of work? And how can we as educators help, bring young and the existing workforce into sort of that mindset?
Sure. Well, I think, and this was a speech that it didn't get a lot of recognition. Mark Carney gave it about 2 years ago, and he talked about a thing called the artisanal economy, which when you think about the phenomenal rise in things like craft breweries now, which are springing up, you know, sourdough bread, which you know, everybody started doing and realized this is bloody hard trying to make sourdough loaf. But we're seeing this desire, I think, from people to look at the artfulness of production now, and what that will mean. Well, I think there's two sides to it. One is, you know, being really frank about this. The we all know the fallout, the economic fallout for this is going to be horrendous. So jobs are going to be lost. I mean, I think personally, if ever there was a time to start experimenting with the universal basic income for young people, particularly, this ought to be the time. But if we can't do that, then I think sadly an awful lot of young people are going to be what I call reluctant freelancers. You know, they wanted a job, they just couldn't find one, so they have to do whatever they can. And the great thing about this shift in this artisanal economy is that because of the internet, you've now got a global market. Websites like Patreon, Etsy, even eBay now, people are able to, you know, I'm not saying they're going to get rich, but they're able to put food on the table simply by whatever it is that they do, whatever service they're providing or whatever the thing is that they're making, they can find an audience for it. And I think this is increasingly going to play a much bigger part in our economy. What does that mean for education? Well, I think it should make us really pause and think. For too long, FE colleges, certainly the one that I worked at, it used to cozy up to big companies. Obviously, they were seen as major local employers, but perhaps what it should be doing is giving students advice about how to set up your own enterprise. You know, how do you do branding? How do you do the marketing, the networking? You know, I'm at a point now where my career should have finished. You know, I'm past retirement age, but I've been working as a freelancer for 20 years, and yeah, I've got the kind of portfolio career that everybody talks about. And sure, it's not easy right now. It's definitely not easy because of COVID, but it's made me realize, you know, I've now got an office that's turned into a TV studio. I understand the power of networks, and this is what I think is happening, which I'm not sure enough of our schools and colleges are aware of. The fact, for instance, that so many recruiters now for companies, they're doing it through LinkedIn, you know, and therefore they're looking at how big is this person's personal network. And all of this is really going to be a factor whether you're being employed by one of the new knowledge tech economies, because that's probably one of the few areas where we're going to see growth, but even more so if you're trying to set up your own small enterprise.
No, definitely. And I think that leads me on to my previous career was recruitment. So I'm going to go into that for definite around the way that's changed around LinkedIn and the way that AI in particular is helping. It then goes back to the algorithm, you know, like with the exam sort of grades really, is around people's understanding of how we interact with AI, and also like things like 3D printing. I mean, what do you see the future for AI and 3D printing for employment and for education?
Well, I think, I forget who it was, but there's that line that a technology only really becomes revolutionary when it becomes commonplace, you know, and we saw that with email, that it was only when everybody was using it and you didn't even think about it that you realized just how profound a change it had been. I think we're still at the early days in terms of 3D printing, but what it does do is it opens the door to that cooperative production. And you know, in some senses, none of this is new. I talk about the Rochdale Pioneers in the book. You know, I lived in Rochdale for a while, and the whole cooperative movement was about peer production. But I think what's interesting is that it was based on a set of values about communities, which, you know, I think we've lost, and I think we can get that back. One of the things that I tried to do in the book was to look at What is it that makes these highly innovative organizations work? You know, I looked at people like BrewDog, the craft brewery up in Scotland. I looked at WD-40, but I looked at NGOs and cooperatives. And they all had a number of kind of qualities that they placed really high reliance on: trust and transparency, engagement, equity, autonomy and agency, and mastery. By that, I mean, you know, making people are making daily progress in meaningful work. And then work was a source of meaning for these people. It mattered to them in their lives. And the kind of light bulb moment for me was when I realized, I think I was sitting in a bar in America, and I was looking at some of the protests that were going on over there, and I thought, yeah, that's the thing. These eight qualities, we've kind of lost them all. We don't trust people anymore. You know, governments aren't as transparent as they used to be. Telling lies is considered to be okay. And I think we need to get them back into our education system so that, apart from anything else, we're growing good human beings. Because I don't know about you, Gavin, but, you know, the young people I meet now, I just think, how are you not out in the streets with pitchforks? Because the thing I said in open was, you know, my generation, we had the party, they've got the hangover. You know, we amassed all of that debt. You've got young people now who think, I'm never going to be able to afford a house. I'm never going to be able to have a pension. And yet, there's no bitterness about them. And there's still a kind of optimism, you know, and thank God it's because they're young. But I just think, this part of me thinks, when you look at the fact that in the last 10 years, there have been more mass movements around the world than there have been in the previous 100. And the two largest demonstrations, public protests that have ever been held in the history of our species were organized by school kids. And that's the Greta Thunberg climate strikes and the Parklands, Florida kids, the March for Our Lives for gun control. And you think, if they can do that, we should just get out of their way and you know, I say in the book, we should just give them the keys to Parliament, because they couldn't do a worse job than the crowd who are in there right now. And I just think that what we've got to do with our education system is to have a values-driven education system. We've got to recognize that the really striking thing about what happened in COVID was that we started to look after one another. And I think we need community-based curriculums going forward. We need students doing work that matters and seeing the value of that. Because frankly, you know, to go back to your AI question, I mean, how messed up do we have to be that in Japan, for example, we're putting these robot buddies into old folks' homes because their granddaughters and grandkids, they're working three jobs at a time. They've got no time to visit. And, you know, Japan's always been this country that places a strong stock on family and looking after your elders. And now we've got a robot who's doing it because the kids aren't having to go out and work so hard. So I feel like what I'd really like to see is that we go, okay, let's give you this basic income, young people, so that you can start caring for your family. You can start caring for your community. You can start to think, how are we going to fix the climate emergency? How are we going to, what are we going to do about mass migration? And there's a new university opened up in London, the London Interdisciplinary School. I don't know if you've come across it, but it's set up by, you know, the School 21 people. And it's the canary in the coal mine, because you don't study to do a degree. You study to solve a wicked problem, like, how can we bring an end to malaria? What do we do about mass migration? That to me is education that means something.
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, 100%. I wanted to talk to you about leadership, and you've got a section in the book which is really interesting to me around hygge culture. Maybe could you explain what that is to the audience and what that could mean for leadership? So I think this, what you're saying, leads in to that, and what we can learn and how we can disseminate.
Yeah. Okay. Well, this probably won't work because it is pouring with rain outside, but I'm going to try and switch the camera, see if I can do this, because it's better to show this, to demonstrate it. Yeah. Yeah. So I don't know if you can see it, but at the bottom of that picture, I've got some sleeper beds, some raised beds. And I know you're, because we've spoken about this, I know you're one of the few people that actually has come across the term hoogle culture. So this is a doer-upper, this house. And when the builder was in, I said, and Rob, I want some raised beds. And so he did them for me, and there's a few more that you can't see. And then we thought, how do we fill them? So I started looking up what you could do, and you know, you can put rubble in there, or you could do this hoogle culture, which is that you basically take bulky organic matter and you put that as the base, and then you put your kind of topsoil and your compost and your manure on top of that. And what it does is that over time, that bulky matter feeds the nutrients to the topsoil. And the theory is that you don't have to keep fertilizing it, you know, all the time. You don't have to keep feeding the soil. And for me, as I was doing this, I was grappling with this question of leadership and how do you build, how do you get people to be ingenious? How do you build that culture of innovation? And of course, I realized that that's what it is. A good leader now isn't the hero who's always got a ton of great ideas. And I speak as somebody who thought I was that person, you know, and I used to manage about 100 academic staff, and I'd forever be coming into, why don't we try this? Why don't we try that? And really, after a while, people stopped having ideas because they just thought, oh, he's going to come in and tell us what we're doing next. And the good leaders now make sure they build that hoogle culture for innovation, create the culture where people can be innovative, and it will just happen naturally. You don't have to do all the heavy lifting.
So basically, it's around developing a culture of getting the foundations in to have the legacy of continual innovation and development.
And we can find inspiration in the strangest of places, because, you know, I've visited schools and colleges and universities all around the world, and the best learning culture I've ever seen was at the headquarters of WD-40, you know, which is a strange thing because it for a long time, it only ever made one product. But the leader there, Gary Ridge, is an Australian, and he's the finest educator I ever saw. And he said when he took over at WD-40, it was just like this river of gold. They were just making money. They didn't know what to do with their dividends. They only ever had one product. And he said it was great, but there was no new ideas coming. He said, and people were afraid as a result of that to suggest anything. And they were afraid to try things. And so he set up this culture, and it's all about the language. He talks about a tribe that he built. You know, the people felt they had a common vocabulary. And people would come in the early days, and they'd say, oh, Gary, I've screwed up. And you go, no, I'm going to stop you there. You haven't failed. You've had a learning moment. The only thing I ask you to do is to share that learning moment with your colleagues so we can all learn from it. And over that, he built, I mean, the engagement level at WD-40 is off the charts. It's like 93% of employees would class themselves as engaged. And, you know, he's got schemes where people go off and they do masters. He's got the learning labs. He's got a lot of peer learning, which is going on. BrewDog is pretty much the same up in Scotland. You know, these companies, in addition to those eight characteristics that I talked about before, the thing that they all had in common was a really strong learning culture. And I know it sounds strange, but actually some of our learning institutions don't have a very good internal learning culture. And I find that puzzling and sad. Yeah, because it's what we do.
Yeah, 100%. It's our builders that are too busy to actually look after their own house, isn't it, type of thing. David, thank you so much for taking all the time out today to chat through just around what's happening in the world at the moment. But I think if that doesn't give a foundation for people to want to you know, click below and have a little bit look at the book in more detail, I don't know what will. And I'm hoping we can do more of these, and we can unpack maybe some different chapters in the books. I think our audience is going to love that. Everything you're covering here, we could talk on each section for about 3 days. I think it's this really, really interesting. And This thank you for your time today. And I agree. Right. I mean,
it's been a pleasure.
What we could do next. Yeah, 100%. Yep. I think it's what we could do next. And I think it's how the sector, because now is our time, it feels, of where we need to be stepping into this gap of where we're going to be helping the employees of the future, the existing employees that have got to pivot and change. We've got to be integral with social mobility. We've got to be integral with helping people have continual, sustainable work. And we need ideas and we need solutions. And anyway,
you're absolutely right. And the phrase I use in the book comes from Thomas Paine, who's an English philosopher, but he lived in America. And at the time of the American Revolution, he wrote this paper. And in that paper, he used the phrase, "The time has found us." And I think that's where we're at now. No one chose for this to happen, but it's an opportunity now. And if we miss out on this, it might never come round again. And we've got a chance. Because let's face it wasn't that great before the coronavirus. So what's to be lost by trying to improve the experience, not just for the learners, but for the people who are learning alongside them, for the educators. And I think increasingly we're going to have to start widening that discussion to include employers, to include community, to include parents. And together we should be able to reconstruct an education that's worth having.
Absolutely. David, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you, Gavin.
I hope you enjoyed this podcast. Why not click subscribe so you can be informed when the latest next individual podcast or podcast mini series from FE News are going to be released.